Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore. We're glad you are tuned in. We continue today with Connie Ellis's reading of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly, a novel about a handful of people in a northern Minnesota town. We pick up now where Connie left off last time.
Chapter 14 continues. The building kept giving its faultless hum. She was stupid to sneer at white noise. If we human beings didn't know how to give ourselves white noise, we would be grieving all the time over dead children in Afghanistan and Iraq and places like those, places that were far away or long past or both. Half of what one hears was white noise. Fair enough. When that receptionist returned, she would apologize and explain that she had been mistaken in making this appointment. She would explain that she was going to do what any sane person does. She was going to get on with her death, her life. She stood up, her jacket over one arm, all set to give her casual, courteous explanation for when the receptionist returned. But it was a different receptionist who entered the room, and from a side door that Emmajeane hadn't noticed. The woman asked her if she were Emmajeane. "I'll take you right in," she said. As they moved, either quickly or slowly, whichever it was, Emmajeane found it impossible to start the perfectly sensible speech she had planned, with its apology for having caused these awfully nice people so much inconvenience. She could not remember how it went. Now she was seated somewhere again. An intelligent face regarded her. She was being lowered into herself. It was too late to apologize and take leave. Another human being was inviting herself into a half-eclipsed place inside herself. How could she ever have spent even a moment willing to be influenced by mechanical sound? All she wanted now was to hear the sound of her own voice. It came to her ears as two sounds. One was a lyrical storytelling fountain of a voice. The other was throttled growling. Both sounds were hers. Person ought to be ashamed to make noises like that, she thought, but only for a second. The lyrical storytelling voice was the voice of a Girl Scout explaining her failure to earn merit badges. That voice told the therapist how her parents were very civilized people who had raised her to forgive Strog, a man she had been married to. They still thought well of him. They were wistful about him. The shame passed. Imogen leaned forward from her chair. She talked with hardly pause for breath to this utterly strange professional person. For beneath any conscious decision-making inside her, she knew that this man was going to help her reconnect some damaged part of her mind. She hoped it wouldn't kill her. He sat opposite. He, like her, leaned forward. Imogen could barely speak, but she was doing it. When she choked, she stopped. She said, "Sorry, I am going to choke for a second." Each time this man's voice was quieter when he replied. Soon he was nearly whispering his replies and questions. They bent toward each other. They were like two people bailing in perfect tandem, while inside one of them a hurricane flung itself again and again against the shelter of their vessel. At least there were two of them. She told him that her ex-husband's name was Strog. "You would think," she told the therapist, "that he would love his infant son enough not to endanger its health." She would not remember his son's name. She promised to tell the therapist that child's name as soon as it came to mind. The therapist listened. She told him how the father of that child loved him and loved to show him off when he was out with friends. The therapist said, "Did Strog have other children?" "Just that one," she said. She told him on that day, Strog and his friend, he had several friends, were fishing in one of those lakes that lie here and there on the iron range with a depleted iron mine, when a depleted iron mine was allowed to fill with groundwater. The therapist asked if Strog's child could stand up or walk by itself. "Not yet," Emmajeane said. "He could not pull himself up yet." By this time, both client and therapist were speaking so quietly that they heard each other's breathing. The therapist then said, "So that infant son of his, he couldn't have pulled himself up and over the boat's edge. He couldn't physically have done it," she said. Excuse me, I'm going to choke. I won't throw up, though. I am fairly sure that I will not throw up. I throw up a good deal, but I will not do it here. He said, you can throw up if you need to. He had arisen already. He brought her a waste paper basket. The choking passed. I don't think that child could have got out. I don't think this child could have fallen out of that boat by himself. The therapist waited. Then she said in an even fainter whisper than before, I am not saying that he lifted the child out and deliberately threw or dropped him overside. I don't know that. I think he had to have lifted the child up and then, for the fun of it, likely swung him around a little because he liked swinging him around, especially when he had friends around. They would look anxious, but he would grin. Then he must have lost him, or he dropped him in to see if he could swim, New Age style. You see, I don't think he intended murder. I think he wanted so much to show the other man. He did it for fun. He was genuinely joyful, adventurous dad. I bet he was doing that, and then he froze up and didn't save the child. And the friend, well, maybe they were both smoking. You would think Strug would be more careful around his son. She stopped talking. Then she said, I have never been so afraid as I am just this minute. A minute passed. The therapist said, where did you go just now? She said, wait a second. I might be going to choke for a second. Just a second. I can wait, the therapist said. She did a little choking. Then he said, if I could come back sometime. Yes, you can, he said promptly. You can come back soon. I want to talk about the other things, if that would be all right. In some dim recess of her ears, she heard herself doing what her clients did sometimes. An odd thing. Asked if it would be all right to talk about something very, very bad. For a pretty murderous species, we are constantly courteous, she thought, splitting herself for a second back into her old self, the therapist, an ordinary person who was going to marry a very nice person named Vern. She was an ordinary school social worker with some private practice, splitting herself back and forward from that person to the deeper self, which lifted itself slowly up and down in her head like a very long swell at sea. I want to come back, she said. I want to be more okay than I am now. The therapist said, you have said that Strug must have lifted up his son in that boat. Yes, he must have. But I want to repeat, she said. I didn't say he meant to murder his son. I think he was having fun with him. He was impressing his friend. He loved to have fun. The therapist glanced down, regarding his knuckles. You're not listening. I'm listening, he said. He waited a minute. Then he said, I want to ask you. You call that little boy Strug's son. I'm going to ask you. Can you say who was the mother of that little boy? She told herself, listen, Imogene, you know this world of therapy. You know nobody can do it if they're chicken. You know that, so do it. So she sat up very straight in order not to choke. She said, I am the mother of that little boy. The therapist started to speak, but he had trouble. Oh, yes, he is having trouble too, Imogene thought. It is nice he is having trouble too. Then he said, you are the parent of a little boy who died possibly because the other parent was showing off to a friend then. Neither of them spoke for a moment. Then he said, I'm not sure I could have borne that. She said, that's right, I can hardly bear it. I have been able to hardly bear it. And now I am through for today. I can't do any more. But you have done so much, the therapist said. You've done such a lot. You have so much courage. It's enough for one day. She looked at him wonderingly. But I still can't think of that little boy's name. He spoke firmly. You will think of it. You don't have to think of his name today. Still, the day wasn't over. Imogene was not throwing up, but she realized that she might howl. She might howl. She gave the therapist a covert glance. She knew it would sound horrible if she howled. He now said, and very fast in a low voice, there is still time. It came out. The howling was 1,000 times louder and more torn sounding than she had been afraid it would be. 1,000 times more. At last it stopped. She found she was kneeling on the floor. She found that the therapist was kneeling too and had held her shoulders all the while. He did not hug her, he just held her shoulders. They both got to their feet. "What are you going to do right now?" he asked. "Are you driving back north? Is someone driving you?" "I'm driving," she said. "I will be safe." Then she said, "I can't believe it's been 4 whole years." 4 years is almost nothing," he said. "Not in anything to do with love, it isn't. It will always be sad. Always. You will always have lost this child. You may have other children, but you will have always lost this little boy. You will never, ever forget him." She could hardly bear it, but she remained standing. He said, "We will work very hard." They talked schedule. They both were spoken for all the next 8 or 9 days. He because he was a famous therapist in Minneapolis. She because she was putting together a package income with no perks. "No, 8 or 9 days is too long from now," the therapist said. "Do you have to cook on Thanksgiving morning or anything? Cheer for a football team or anything?" They both laughed. He said if she could show up early on Thanksgiving morning, they could do 1 hour and he would have another hour free too if they wanted it. They were walking toward the door. "Now here's advice. Please take it," he said. "Drive very slowly home, very slowly. And when you feel any difficult feeling coming on, pull over to the side. About those rest stops, at least as far as Duluth. Pull off at each one of them. You may likely get very sleepy. Go to sleep in every one of them if you feel like it." He gave her a respectful smile and said, "Can you stand one more piece of advice?" She said, "I know a good therapist when I see one. What's the one more piece of advice?" "This may sound dumb," he said. "It isn't. Sometimes a person's eyes fill with tears while they think over a profound conversation. We don't know for certain what those tears are about. Sometimes those tears seem to come only because so much truth has been caught at that a person's heart is surprised by it, by so much truth best for its own sake. Anyway, if your eyes fill with tears for any reason, pull off the road." Back outside, Imogene's remote made her car give its baby animal bleats. She climbed in. She drove so slowly north, it was as if the earth were trying to grasp her tires. It was clutching at her car. "All right, then," she thought, not complaining. "A lot of people have never been married to someone who, for years, fancied the edge, taking chances, frightening people for years before actually killing. Yet such people must be around us all the time, nearby or not." She added, "Yes, and inside the rest of us somewhere, too." She knew that much. She wasn't a therapist for nothing. Chapter 15. Whenever you put on a public celebration, somebody gets their feelings hurt. Men and women in departments of state and in armies get inured to it by the time they're 30, or they'd be crying on their desktops every day. That is the way it's always been. Those in the loop that count march after the colors or get handsomely seated in the front row. Still, ordinary citizens and especially small town people keep hoping that somehow the honors will be dealt with fairly, really fairly, this once, just this once. They never are, and somebody always gets their vanity kicked. At St. Fursey's most carefully planned annual occasion, Veterans Evening, there were this year 3 different sets of hurt feelings. First, George Herzlich happened to be serving as mayor. He would be the one to walk up the aisle to the platform, immediately followed by the big-shot speaker who had been brought in from out of town. That part was okay, and he had figured out exactly what had to happen and what he himself would say. But Peter Tenebrae, who wasn't mayor or a St. Fursey Public Library official, got deferred to like God because there had to be a dinner party before the doings. There had to be a private home for the speaker to stay at, and it had to be a sumptuous private home. The Herzlich's house was a nice place, but its one guest room and both of the boys' old rooms were filled with Mersenne's knitting projects and skeins and 2 old brother machines that George kept straightening the needles on. What's more, Mersenne froze at the very idea of cooking for someone who would be used to fancy food. You couldn't fry up pork chops and make frozen beans and mushroom soup hot dish for a general, and as for overnight. Even if she got all the stuff off one of the beds, she and George hadn't bought new sheets for decades. You couldn't tell some big shot general that the reason his top sheet had a nearly you couldn't tell some big shot general that the reason his top sheet had a neatly sewn patch on it was that his hosts had saved up and then sent two children to college. Then he even made both of them huge loans at 3% to eke out down payments on houses. George felt embarrassed. Stan Garris, without whose aged mother this big shot wouldn't be coming to St. Percy at all, hadn't health or house or wife to do a crispy little dinner, plus overnight stay for the speaker. Stan had cancer and looked like hell, probably felt like hell, too, because Doc Anderson had bawled him out for missing the chemo appointment set up for him in Duluth. He had given in at last and started the therapy. He had decided he was dying, and the doctor told him he wasn't. But Stan couldn't get convinced that the doctor was telling him the truth. Even without the sickness, however, Stan was definitely not one of those St. Percy area, out-of-the-knot-hole top-drawer intellectuals. He and his visibly, audibly, famously horrible wife had never been invited to the Tenebrae's dinner parties. Peter and Natalie Tenebrae found out at the last minute that the speaker was a retired American brigadier general. The Tenebrae's would have liked to be in the loop with the town leaders pulling off this event, but they hadn't been. Peter hid his personal hurt. He asked the mayor if he and Nat could do a very simple supper before the presentation. A chicken marengo, say, because advance prep left you free to join the guests. And, of course, George and his committee might have already arranged something else, but if not, might Peter and Nat put the general up for the night? George was most relieved and said so. When you had a brigadier general coming on a 3.5-hour drive to do a freebie, the Tenebrae's was the right thing. Peter took a small notebook from his vest pocket. If George would give him the list, he would see they all got invited to dinner. And if George thought it suitable, the World War II vets, at least those who fought on our side. Peter laughed. Of course, it was all a good idea. This was Tenebrae-type stuff, not Herzlich-type stuff. Chicken marengo, whatever the heck that might be. Of course, everyone would want to eat it, drink whatever was offered before it and during it. About the World War II vets, those on our side, George opened his mouth, so to say something and closed it again. Even Natalie Tenebrae's feelings were harrowed up because Peter told her, hands down, she had to clear the guest wing of all dead soldiers, empties, and do it immediately, and he would inspect. Arlene Strop was proud that Mr. Tenebrae trusted her to make sure of the sheets, pillowcases, blanket, and an unused bar of soap in the second larger guest wing bath. Would it be all right to break open that package of new towels and matching face cloths she'd seen? Way to go, Arlene, Peter shouted. No one around Peter got his feelings hurt. This was Daryl, the deputy cop. Daryl was a member of the VFW at its second lowest level. At the local post, he had somehow been made sergeant-at-arms. This meant he should have been the one to carry the colors up the aisle of the library meeting room, up the two steps to the platform, do a smart heel swivel about, place the United States flag at right as the audience would see it, leaving the Minnesota flag in its stand at left. The mayor, however, explained to Daryl that it was to be the sergeant-at-arms of the auxiliary who would carry colors on Veterans Evening. The auxiliary? George said, Pearl has offered to go down to the cities and pick up the general and drive him both ways. Daryl raised his voice. I could do that, he said. Herzlich said, Garris Auto is providing a 2007 Buick Terraza. Daryl said, I can sure drive as safe as Pearl any day of the week. He added, I should think you'd want a man doing a man's job. A little of Daryl's spit struck George Herzlich. The answer is no, George said. On the night itself, the St. Percy Public Library was beautiful. Bridget Garris had been authorized by the committee to spend some money on flowers. She decided to decorate not only the meeting room itself, but the small back lounge which served as her office. The city had put a handsome sofa for her. Years ago, two ladies had crocheted some throw pillows and a matching afghan for the Senior Citizen Center. When the center was given over to the chief of police, these ladies brought their knitted materials over to the library because Bridget Garris, who was still the librarian for all these years, wasn't getting any younger, and she might appreciate them. And there was no point in leaving handmade craftwork for that dirty-looking deputy to ruin. Bridget imagined ahead how it would be. Pearl would be in her uniform white blouse and royal blue VFW suit. She would bring that Buick around from Tenebrae's when they were through with supper. They would use the back door with the glass window so Pearl could park, and because she would be in uniform, she would show good snap when she opened the passenger door for the general. Things were democratic these days. He would probably sit up front with Pearl. The other supper guests would have gone ahead to get themselves seats in the meeting room. Pearl would lead the general to Bridget's office. Bridget jotted down, pitcher, water, glass. Bridget said to herself, it was actually all going to happen. If only Stan weren't so sick. She still could hardly get it through her head that a child of hers might die before she herself did. Otherwise, she felt happy. The meeting room filled fast. In his Boy Scout uniform, Marty Hanks, Jr. did not look like someone who picked his nose in a church chancel. He guided the World War II veterans to their armchairs in the front row. Ward Hines, Walt Steinsider. Everyone else just had ordinary auditorium chairs. Walt Steinsider weighed almost 300 pounds, so he walked without any spring to his step, but his son ordered for him a custom-fitted VFW dress blue uniform. Walt knew he looked good, even if he was a heavy fellow. His huge face was bright with Peter Tenebrae's single malt. As he made his way up to the reserved seat, he noted here and there in the audience the local clowns he knew he could still beat the pants off. He saw that 6'1" piece of shit, the deputy cop, too. He meant to straighten him out later tonight after the doings. Darrell was seated on the aisle in his police uniform. Others crowded in who had not been invited to the Tenebrae's and were not full of Peter Tenebrae's booze. Most of them were up for some hilarity anyhow. They shouted greetings and chaff, making too much noise to hear much other than themselves. The Boy Scouts urged the guests of honor to keep moving forward. Marty Hanks said, "Sir, you want to come along now? They got your seat reserved for you." A third armchair was marked reserved on the right-hand side. Marty said, "You're on this side, sir, next to Mr. Hines." Walt belched and pointed. "Who's that one for, then?" Marty said sternly, "You're on this side, sir." At last, it was 7:30. People instinctively lowered their voices, knowing that the MC for the evening would shush them any second now. Two high school seniors came forward, one with a trumpet damped and the other with a flute. They went up onto the platform behind the lectern to their skinny metal music stands. At last, a stir at the back. Ordinary people didn't set much store by whatever happened to be the mayor of St. Fursey. None of the town's affairs went through his hands at all. St. Fursey was a town run by its clergy and a car dealer who was a nice guy of long standing and the Tenebrae family. Still, here's the mayor, George Herzlick, this year. Okay, nothing wrong with George Herzlick. The high school kids did a fanfare and then a march that was more lyrical than military. People didn't stand. The VFW auxiliary sergeant-at-arms came by with the flag. Next came the mayor, then the commander of the veterans of foreign wars, the two Boy Scouts who had returned from ushering so they could be in this procession. The little procession got slower since those at the head paused before taking the step to get up onto the dais. The music stopped. Silence. George Herzlick returned down the aisle. Some voice in the audience said too loudly, "Now it's wrong." A woman's voice said, "Why don't you wait and see? Can't you ever just wait without making a fuss once?" George was not in his navy green Carasotto suit. He wore what the mayors always wore on Veterans Evening, dark suit, white shirt, and a black tie in mourning for the American dead of all wars. Was so quiet you could hear a cough, there a mild creak of a chair. Then George Herzlick's voice, very clear in the back, "Sir, if you'll come up now." To the delight of everyone in the room, a straight-backed, elegant old soldier in the rarely seen dress blue of the army was now accompanying George forward. He was of medium height with a strong neck and wavy, completely silver hair, shaved rather high and back in the military way. He carried his cap under his arm. He brought no notes to speak from. He walked firmly. People took in his uniform, and those who knew insignia whispered to those who didn't. The word got passed along. The words, "It's a brigadier general," lifted lightly and went around the room. A A brigadier general, a real one, other whispers followed. That's the European Theater of Operations medal. That's a brown star. No, it isn't either. That's a silver star. I can't see. Would you move your head? Oh, don't fuss. Once he gets up there, you'll turn around and you'll see all you want. When everyone stood on the platform, George Herzlich came forward to the lectern. He tinkered with the mic a second, looked over to the piano on the far right. Pearl, having set the flag into its standing bracket, raised a thumb. Welcome, everybody, George said. Our national anthem. Everyone stood up as fast as they could. Pearl played the last bars. Everyone sang as loud as they could. George Herzlich then waited until everyone had sat down. He said, We have a very special speaker tonight, and he is bringing a wonderful message, especially for us here in St. Fursey. George turned to smile at the general, who smiled back. Because we have this special speaker and program, we are shortening our usual Veterans Day agenda a little. We won't have taps, but we'll have the reading of the names of all St. Fursey men and women who have served in the wars. Then we will introduce our speaker, and he will take over from there. Well, and here George turned on his car sales term. I ask you, if a brigadier general in the United States can't take over, then we'd be in bad shape. Everyone was pleased to laugh. They'd been delighted to be awed. They'd been pleased to sing the Star-Spangled Banner solemnly instead of in the half-assed way that overpaid entertainers hyped it up at Super Bowl. And they would be pleased to give some thought, a short, invisible, inward salute to people who never got to live past their youth. When the names were read aloud, they planned to be pleased to imagine, as well as they could, the dead Civil War privates of the Minnesota 1st Infantry. But for this moment, they wanted to laugh at George's gag. The visiting general laughed, too. Everyone on the podium sat down. Old Walt Steinsetter got up from his chair. He opened the sheet he would read from. No one brought him the battery-run mic. When his voice came out, however, it was loud. The 16-year-olds in the room could hear names of dead men and feel the force of what it meant to live and then inevitably to die, even if you got decorated by President Lincoln. Walt sat down.
You've been listening to episode 19 out of 20 of Carol Bly's Shelter Half. Be sure to tune in tomorrow for the conclusion of this book. Remember, you can always access the current and previous week's episodes of a book on our website, ktwh.org. Just look for Literally from the North Shore under the drop-down menu under Programs.
The piano music filling out these Shelter Half episodes is performed by Robert Ellis, our reader Connie Ellis's husband, from his CD, Moonrise. Thank you.